Osho. Seeds of Revolution. My most loved gospel on Jesus. Commentaries on the fifth gospel of St. Thomas. Discourse number 6. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Bhagwan, Jesus said, "The kingdom is like a shepherd who had 100 sheep. One of them went astray, which was the largest. He left behind the 99. He sought for the one until he had found it. Having tired himself out, he said to the sheep, 'I love thee more than the 99.
One of the most puzzling problems has been, what will happen to the sinners, those who have gone astray? What's the relationship between the divine and the sinner? Is the sinner going to be punished? Is there going to be a hell? Because all the priests have been insisting that the sinner is going to be thrown into the hell. He is to be punished. But can God punish anybody? Is there not compassion enough? And if God cannot forgive, then who will be able to forgive? Many answers have been given, but Jesus' answer is the most beautiful. Before we enter into this saying, many other things have to be understood. They will give you the background. Whenever we punish a person, rationalizations may be whatsoever we like, but the reason is different. And remember the distinction between reason and rationalization. You may be a father or a mother, and the child has done something which you don't approve. It does not matter whether he has done something right or wrong, because who knows what is right and what is wrong. But you disapprove, and whatsoever you disapprove becomes wrong. It may be, it may not be. That is not the point. Whatsoever you approve is right. So it depends on your approval and disapproval. And when a child goes astray, is doing something wrong, in your view, you punish him. Deep reason is that he has disobeyed. Not that he has done something wrong. The deep reason is that your ego feels hurt. The child has been in a conflict with you. He has asserted himself. He has said no to you, the father, the authority, the powerful. You punish the child. Reason is that your ego is hurt, and punishment is a sort of revenge. But rationalization is different. You say because he has done wrong and he has to be put right. Unless he is punished, how he is going to be right? So he should be punished when he moves in a wrong way. He should be awarded when he follows you. That's how he is to be conditioned for a right life. This is the rationalization. This is how you talk about it in your mind. But this is not the basic unconscious reason. The unconscious reason is totally different. It is to put the child in his place, remind him that you are the boss and he is not the boss. That you will decide what is wrong and what is right. That it is you who are going to give him direction. That he is not free. That you possess him. That you are the owner. And if he disobeys, then he will suffer. If you ask the deaf psychologist, they will say, in all behaviors, this distinction has to be understood well, reason and the rationalization. Rationalization is a very cunning device. It hides the real reason and gives a false thing to you, but looks absolutely okay on the surface. And this is happening not only between a father and a child, mother and a child, it is happening between the society and those children who have gone astray. That's why the prison exists, the law exists. It is a revenge. Revenge from the society. The society cannot tolerate somebody who is rebellious. Because he will destroy the whole structure. He may be right. Athens could not tolerate Socrates. Not that he was wrong. He was absolutely right. But Athens could not tolerate, because if he is tolerated, then the whole structure of the society will be gone, thrown to the dogs. Then the society cannot exist. Socrates has to be sacrificed to society. Jesus was crucified not because whatsoever he was saying was wrong. Never such true words have been asserted on this earth. But he was sacrificed to the society because the way he was talking, the way he was behaving was dangerous to the structure. Society cannot tolerate. It will punish you. But it also rationalizes. It says just to put you right. It punishes you for your own good. And nobody ever bothers whether that good is achieved ever or not. We have been punishing criminals. Since thousands of years, but nobody bothers whether those criminals are ever transformed through our punishment or not. Criminals go on increasing. As prisons increase, prisoners increase. More laws, more criminals. More courts, more punishments. The result is absolutely absurd. More criminality. What is the problem? The criminal can also feel that This is rationalization, that he is punished for the wrong. He is punished because he has been caught. He has also his rationalization. So next time he has to be more cunning and more clever, that's all. This time he has been caught because he was not alert. Not because he has done wrong. The society proved more clever than him. Next time he will see. And he is going to prove himself more cunning, clever, intelligent. And then he will not be caught. A prisoner, a criminal who is punished always thinks that he is punished not for the thing he has committed, but because he has been caught. So the only thing he is going to learn from the punishment is not to be caught again. So whenever a prisoner comes out of the prison, he is now a better criminal than ever. He lived with experienced people inside the prison, with more advanced adepts who know much, who have been punished much and who have suffered long, who have been caught and who have been deceiving in many, many ways, who are very advanced on the path of crime. Living with them, serving them, becoming a disciple to them, he learns. He learns through experience that next time he is not to be caught, then he is a better criminal. Nobody is stopped by punishment, but the society goes on thinking that it is because the wrong has to be stopped, we punish. Both are wrong. The society has some other reason, it takes revenge. And the criminal, he also understands. Because egos understand each other's languages very easily, howsoever unconscious. The criminal also thinks, okay, I will take revenge. When my time comes, I will see. Then a conflict exists between the criminal's ego and the society's ego. Is God the same? Just like a justice, a magistrate, just like a father or a boss. Is God also cruel in the same way as the society is? Is God also the same deep down an egoist as we are? Will he take revenge if you disobey? Will he punish you? Then he is no more divine. Then he is just an ordinary man as we are. This is one of the profoundest problems. How God will behave with a sinner who has gone astray? Will he be kind? Then there are other things implied. Another thing, if he wants to be just, he cannot have compassion. Because justice and compassion cannot exist together. Compassion means unconditional forgiveness. But it is not just. Because it is possible, a saint continuously prayed his whole life, never did anything wrong, was always afraid of moving beyond the boundary, lived in his own confinement, created an imprisonment for himself, never did anything wrong. The whole life remained virtuous, never allowed himself any enjoyment of the senses, was very austere. And then another man who lived, indulged, did whatsoever came to his mind, wherever his senses led him went, whatsoever the world gave, enjoyed, did all types of things, all types of sins, then both reached to the divine, both reached to God's world. What will happen? If the saint is not awarded and the sinner is not punished, it will be very unjust. If both are awarded, that too will be unjust, because the saint will think that I lived a good life, but nothing special is given to me for it. And if the sinner is also awarded in the same way, then what is the use of being a saint? The whole thing becomes futile. Then God may be compassionate, but he is not just. But if he is just, then in our minds the arithmetic is clear. The sinner has to be punished, the saint has to be awarded. But then he cannot have compassion. A just man has to be cruel, because otherwise justice cannot be done. A just man has to live in the head, not in the heart. A magistrate should not have a heart, otherwise his justice will waver. He should not have any kindness in him, because kindness will become a barrier to do justice. A man who is just must become like a computer. Just the head, laws, awards, punishments, no heart enters into it. No feeling should be allowed. He should remain a spectator, unfeeling, as if there is no heart in him. But then a difficult problem arises, because since centuries we have been saying God is both just and compassionate, kind, loving, and yet just. Then it is a contradiction, a paradox. And how to solve it? Jesus has one answer, and the most beautiful. Now try to understand his answer. It will be difficult, because it will go against all your preconceptions, against all your prejudices, because Jesus is not a believer in punishment. Nobody like Jesus can be a believer in punishment, because punishment is deep down revenge. A Buddha, a Krishna, a Jesus, they cannot believe in punishment. Rather, on the contrary, they can drop the very quality of justice from God. But compassion cannot be dropped, because justice is a human ideal. Compassion is divine. Justice has conditions with it. Do this and you will achieve this. Don't do that, otherwise you will miss this. Compassion has no conditions. God is compassionate. And to understand his compassion, we have to start from the sinner. Jesus said, the kingdom is like a shepherd who has 100 sheep. One of them went astray, which was the largest. He left behind the 99, he sought for the one until he had found it. Having tired himself out, he said to the sheep, I love thee more than the 99. Absurd, illogical, but true. Try to understand. The kingdom of God is like a shepherd who had 100 sheep. One of them went astray, which was the largest. It is always so. One who goes astray is always the best. If you are a father and you have 5 children, only the best child will try to resist and deny. Only the best child will assert himself. The mediocre ones will always yield to you. That who is not mediocre will rebel, because the very quality of mind is rebellion. Intelligence is rebellious. More intelligent, more rebellion. And those who are not rebellious are easiers, are almost dead. You may like them, but they have no life in them. They follow you not because they love you. They follow you because they are weak. They are afraid. They cannot stand alone. They cannot stand against. They are weaklings, impotent. Look around. People who you think are good are almost always those who are weak. Their goodness does not come out of their strength. It comes out of their weakness. They are good because they cannot dare to be bad. But what type of goodness is this which comes out of weakness? Goodness must come out of overflowing strength. Only then it is good, because then it has a life, a flood-like life. So whenever a sinner becomes a saint, the saintliness has its own glory. But whenever an ordinary man, because of his weakness, becomes a saint, the saint is pale and dead. There is no life in it. But you can become a saint out of weakness. Then remember, you will miss. If you become a saint out of your strength, only then you will reach. A man who is good because he cannot be bad is not really good. The moment he becomes stronger, he will become bad. Give him power and power will corrupt him immediately. This happened in this country. Gandhi had a great following, but it seems the goodness of his followers came out of weakness. They were good when they were not in power, but when they came in power, when they became the rulers of this country, then the power corrupted them immediately. Can power corrupt a powerful man? Never. Because he was already powerful. If power can corrupt him, power would have corrupted him already. Power corrupts only if you are weak and your goodness comes out of weakness. Lord Acton has said that power corrupts, and corrupts absolutely, but I would like to make it conditional. This statement is not unconditional, not categorical, cannot be. Power corrupts if goodness comes out of weakness. If goodness comes out of strength, no power can corrupt. How power can corrupt? Because you know it already, it is there. But very difficult to find from where your goodness is coming. If you are not a thief because you are afraid of being caught, the day you become certain now nobody can catch you, you will be a thief. Because then who will prevent you? Only your fear was the prevention. You are not going to murder your enemy because you know you will be caught. But if a situation arises where you can murder the man and you cannot be caught and you cannot be punished for it, you will murder immediately. So it is only weakness that you are good. But how out of weakness good can arise? Because goodness needs overflowing energy. Goodness is a luxury, remember. Saintliness is a luxury, it comes out of affluence. When there is too much energy, so much so that you are flooded with it, then you start sharing it. Then you cannot exploit because there is no need. Then you can give out of your heart because you have got so much. Really, you are burdened. You would like to share and renounce. You would like to throw and give all your life as a gift. When you have something, you would like to give it. Remember this law. You cling only when you don't really own it. If you own it, you can give it. Only when you can give it something happily, you were the owner. If you were still clinging to it, then deep down you were afraid and you were not the master of it. You knew deep down that it does not belong to you, and sooner or later it will be taken away from you. That's why you cannot give. So only when a person gives his love, he shows that he has love. When only one person gives his whole life, he shows that he was alive. There is no other way to know it. Out of weakness, much goodness appears. It is an appearance. It is a false coin. But a false coin is just like a paper flower or a plastic flower. Whenever a tree flowers, it flowers only when it is flooded with too much energy. Flowers are luxuries. A tree flowers only when it can afford. If water is not given in right proportion, if fertilizers are not given right proportion, if the soil is not rich, then the tree may have leaves but it cannot have flowers. There is a hierarchy. The highest can exist only when there is energy to move to the highest. If you are not fed well, intelligence will disappear first, because that is a flowering. In a poor country, the real poverty is not the poverty of the body, the real poverty is of intelligence. Because if the country is very poor, intelligence cannot exist. It is a flowering. When all the bodily needs are fulfilled, only then energy moves higher. When the bodily needs are not fulfilled, the energy moves to fulfill the bodily needs first. Because the base has to be protected first. The root has to be protected first. If there is no root, there cannot be any flowering. If there is no body, then where the intelligence will exist? And compassion is even higher than intelligence. Meditation is still higher. In India, Buddha and Mahavir were produced when the country was very rich. Since then, so-called saints have existed, but not like a man like a Buddha. Difficult. Very difficult, because such a flowering is possible only when useless energy is there and which cannot be used. Only then the energy starts enjoying itself. And when energy starts enjoying itself, it becomes an inner turning. Then it becomes meditation. Then a Buddha is born. Then ecstasy exists. Don't give water to the tree. First the flowers will disappear. Then the leaves will disappear. Then the branches will die. And in the last moment only, roots will die. Because with roots, things can come up again. So the tree will protect the root. And root is the lowest. But the lowest has to be protected because it is the foundation. When good days will come and there will be water and the rains will come, then again the root can sprout. Again the leaves will come. Again the flowering. And this same hierarchy exists in you. Be good out of your energy. Never be good out of your weakness. I'm not saying be bad, because out of weakness, how you can be bad also? Badness needs energy as much as goodness. You cannot be bad. You cannot be evil without energy. You cannot be good without energy, because both are real. Then what you can be without energy, you can just have a false face. You will not be anything. You will just be a facade, a deception, a ghost, not a real person. Whatsoever you do will be ghost-like. And this is what is happening. Then you will create a false goodness, a false saintlyhood. You will think you are a saint because you have not committed any sin. Not because you have attained the divine. When you have attained the divine, it is an achievement, a positive energy achievement. And then you become godlike. And there is then no effort to be godlike. It flows spontaneously. You can resist, that is negative. But when you resist, the desire is there. And if the desire is there to do evil, you have committed it. It makes no difference. That is the difference between sin and crime. Crime has to be an act. You can go on thinking no court can punish you, because no court has the authority for the mind, only for the body. A crime has to be an act. I can go on thinking of murdering the whole world. No court can punish me just because I go on thinking. I can say I enjoy. But I have not murdered anybody. It has not become an act. Act comes under the law, not thought. And this is the difference between sin. Sin does not make any difference whether you act or you think. You think, the seed is there. Whether it sprouts in the act or not is not the problem. If it becomes an act, then it will be a crime. But if you have thought it, you have already committed the sin. For the divine, you have become a criminal. You have gone astray. But this is the point to be understood, very difficult, that those who go astray are always more powerful than those who remain on the path. Those who go astray are always the best. Go to a madhouse and see. And you will find the most intelligent people who have gone mad. Look at the past 70 years of this century. The most intelligent people have gone mad. Not the mediocre ones. Nietzsche goes mad. One of the best intelligence ever born has to go mad. So much energy. So much energy that it cannot be confined. So much energy that it has to become a flood. It cannot be a gentle stream. You cannot channelize it. It is like your ocean. Wild. Nietzsche went mad. Nijinsky went mad. Look at the 70 years of this century and you will find the best, the cream, the very best went mad and mediocres were sane. This looks very absurd. Mediocres are sane and genius goes mad. Why a mediocre person remains sane? No energy to move astray. A child becomes a problem child when he has much more energy. He has to do something or other. Only a bloodless child remains in the corner. If you say to him, repeat Ram, 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 he will repeat. If you give him a rosary, he will do it. But if the child is really alive, then he will throw the rosary and he will say, this is stupid. I am going to play and I am going to climb on the trees. I am going to do something. Life is energy. Only a bloodless, animic mind will not go astray. Cannot go. It is difficult to afford that much. It is difficult to move to that extreme, to that abyss. But those who go astray, if they are ever found, they become Buddhas. If Nietzsche ever goes into meditation, he will be a Buddha. He has the energy to become mad. He has the energy to become enlightened. The same energy, only the direction changes. A Buddha will become mad if he is not going to become a Buddha. Where the energy will go? If you cannot be creative, energy becomes destructive. Go to the madhouses, you will find the most intelligent men there. They are mad only because they are not mediocre. They are mad because they can see further than you, deeper than you, and when they say deeper than you, illusions disappear. The whole life is such a puzzling thing that if you can see deeper, it will be very difficult to remain sane. Very difficult. One remains sane because one cannot see. You see only 2% of life. 98%, psychologists say, has been closed. Because if you come to see it, it will be such a flood. You will not be able to tolerate it. You will go insane, berserk. Now, few psychologists, those who have been studying madness very deeply, like R.D. Lang and others, they are stumbling on certain facts. And one of the facts is this, that people who go mad are the best. People who go into crime are the most rebellious. They can become great saints. And it is not a surprise if a Valmiki becomes a saint. Valmiki was a dacoit, a murderer. He lived by murder and loot. And a sudden happening, and he became enlightened. One enlightened person was passing, and Valmiki was a murderer, a man who lived on theft. He caught hold of this enlightened man. The enlightened man said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I am going to rob you of all that you have." The enlightened man said, "If you could do that, I will be happy, because I have something very inner. Rob it, you are welcome." Valmiki could not understand it, but he said, "I am concerned only with outward things." The enlightenment said, "But they won't help much. And why you are doing this?" He said, "Because of my family, for my family, my mother, my wife, my children. They will go. They will be starving if I don't do that, and I only know this art." So the enlightenment said, "You bind me with a tree so I cannot escape, and you go back and ask your mother and your wife and your children that you are committing sin for them. Are they ready to share the punishment? When you will be before God, when the last judgment will come, will they be ready to share the punishment?" Valmiki, for the first time, started thinking. He said, "You may be right. I should go and ask." He went back, asked the wife. The wife said, "Why I should share? I have not done anything. If you do anything, it is your responsibility." The mother said, "Why I should share? I am your mother. It is your duty to feed me. I don't know how you bring the bread. That's your responsibility." Nobody was ready to share. And the Valmiki became converted. He came back, fell into the feet of the enlightened man, and said, "Now give me the inner. I am not interested in the outer. Now let me be the robber of the inner, because I have understood that I am alone, and whatsoever I am doing, it is my responsibility. Nobody is going to share it. I am born alone, I will die alone, and whatsoever I do is my individual responsibility, personal. Nobody is going to share. So I must look now inwards and find who I am. Finished. I am finished with this whole business." This man turned into a second. The same story happens with Buddha. One man was there. Who was almost mad, a mad murderer. He has taken a vow that he will kill 1,000 persons, not less than that, because the society has not treated him well. So he will take the revenge. He will kill 1,000 persons. And from every killed person, he will take one finger and will make a rosary around his neck. 1,000 fingers. Because of this, his name became Angulimal, the man with a rosary of fingers. He killed 999 persons. Nobody will move in that part wherever people will come to know that Angulimal is. The traffic will stop. And it was very difficult to find one man for him now, and only one man was needed. Buddha was passing through a forest. People came to him from the villages. They said, "Don't go. Angulimal is there, that mad murderer, and he will not think twice. He simply murders. And he will not think that you are a Buddha. Don't go on that way. There is another way. You can move through that, but don't pass from this forest." Buddha said, "If I don't go, then who will go? And he is waiting for one. I have to go. Because he has almost completed his vow. And a man of energy, because the whole society he is fighting. And the kings were afraid. Generals were afraid. And only one man killed 1,000 people. And the government and the law and the police, nobody could do anything. So Buddha said, he is a man, he needs me. I must take the risk. Either he will kill me or I will kill him." And this is what Buddhas do. They stick the risk. Buddha went. Even the closest disciples who have said that they will remain with him up to the very end, they started lagging behind. Because this was dangerous. When Buddha reached near the hill where Angulimal was sitting on a rock, there was no one behind him. He was alone. All the disciples had disappeared. Angulimal looked at this innocent man, childlike, so beautiful. He thought even a murderer felt compassion for him. He thought that this man seems to be absolutely unaware that I am here, otherwise nobody passes from this path. And the man looked so innocent, so beautiful, that even Angulimal thought, it is not good to kill this man. Leave him, I can find somebody else. Then he said to Buddha that go back, stop there and then, and go back. Don't move a step forward. I am Angulimal, and these are 999 fingers here, and I need one finger more. Even if my mother comes, I will kill her and fulfill my vow. So don't come near. I am dangerous. And I am not a believer of religion. And I don't bother who you are. You may be a very good monk, a great saint. Maybe. I don't bother. I only bother about the finger. And your finger is as good as anybody else. So don't come a single step, otherwise I will kill you. Stop. But Buddha continued moving. Then Angulimal thought, either this man is deaf or mad. He again shouted that, stop, don't move. Buddha said, I have stopped long ago. I am not moving, Angulimal, you are moving. I have stopped long ago. All movement has stopped. Because all motivation has stopped. When there is no motivation, how movement can happen? There is no goal for me. I have achieved the goal. So why should I move? You are moving. And I say to you, you stop. And Angulimal was sitting on the rock. He started laughing. He said, you are really mad. I am sitting and you say to me that you are moving. And you are moving. And you say that you have stopped. You are really a fool or a mad, or I don't know what type of, what manner of man you are. Buddha reached near and he said, I have heard that you need one finger more. As far as this body is concerned, my goal is achieved. This body is useless. When I die, people will burn it. It will be of no one's use. You can use it. Your bow can be fulfilled. You cut my finger and cut my head. I have come purposefully because this is the last chance for my body to be used in some way. Otherwise, people will burn it. Angli Mal said, what are you saying? I have been thinking that I am the only madman around here. And don't try to be clever because I am dangerous. I can still kill you. Buddha said, before you kill me, do one thing. Just the wish of a dying man. You cut a branch of this tree. Angulimal hit his sword against the tree. A big branch fell down. Buddha said, just one thing more. Join it again to the tree. Angulimal said, now I perfectly know that you are mad. I can cut, but I cannot join. Then Buddha started laughing and he said, when you can only destroy and cannot create, you should not destroy. Because destruction can be done by children, there is no bravery in it. This branch can be cut by a child. But to join it, a master is needed. And if you cannot join even a branch to the tree back, how you can cut human heads? Have you thought it ever? Angulimal closed his eyes, fell down in Buddha's feet, and he said, you lead me on that path. And it is said in a single moment he became enlightened. Next day he was a bhikkhu, a beggar, Buddha's beggar, and was begging in the city. The whole city was closed. People were so much afraid, they said that even if he has become a beggar, he cannot be believed. That man is so dangerous. People were not there on the roads. When Angulimal came to beg, nobody was there to give him food, because who will take the risk? People were standing on their terraces and looking down, and then they started throwing stones at him because he had killed 1,000 men of that town. Almost every family has been a victim. So they started throwing stones. Angulimal fell down on the street. Blood was flowing from all over his body, many wounds, and Buddha came with his disciples and she said, look, Angulimal, how you are feeling? Angulimal opened his eye and said, I am so grateful to you. They can kill the body, they cannot touch me. And that's what I was doing my whole life and never realized the fact. Buddha said, Angulimal has become enlightened. He has become a Brahmin, a knower of Brahma. In a single moment it can happen if the energy is there. If the energy is not there, then it is difficult. Whole system of yoga is how to create energy, more energy. The whole tantra dynamics is how to create more energy in you so you become a flood-like phenomena. Then you can become good or bad. Jesus says, one of them went astray, which was the largest. Only those who are great, who are best, go astray. The sinners are the most beautiful people in the world. Gone wrong, of course. They can become saints any moment. Saints are beautiful, sinners are beautiful, but the people who are just in between, they are ugly. Because impotence is the only ugliness. When you don't have any energy, when you are already a dead thing, a corpse, somehow carrying yourself or others carrying you, why the best why the great go astray. There is a secret to be understood. The process of growth is, first you have to attain the ego. If you don't attain to a crystallized ego, surrender is never possible. Looks paradoxical, but this is how it is. First you have to attain a very crystallized ego, and then you have to drop it. If you don't attain to a crystallized ego, surrender can never happen to you. How can you surrender something which you have not got? A rich man can renounce his riches. What a beggar should do? He has no riches to renounce. A great scholar can throw his intellect. But what a mediocre person will do? How he can throw, because he has not got it? If you have knowledge, you can renounce it and become ignorant, humble. But if you don't have any knowledge, how you can renounce it? Socrates could say that I don't know anything. This is the second part. He knew much. Then he realized that all knowledge is useless. But this cannot be attained by a person who has not moved like Socrates. Intellect has to be trained. Knowledge has to be gained. Ego has to be crystallized. This is the first part of life. When you have them, renounce them. The difference is great. A beggar on the street and Buddha on the street, both are beggars. But the quality absolutely differs. Buddha is a beggar by his own will. He is not forced to be a beggar. It is his freedom. Buddha is a beggar. He has tasted riches and found them futile. Buddha is a beggar. He lived through desire and found it futile, useless. Buddha is a beggar because the kingdom has failed. Buddha's beggary has a richness about it. No king can be so rich, because he is still half the way. Buddha has completed the circle. And a beggar is standing on the road who has never been rich. His begging is simply begging. He does not know the taste of riches. How can he renounce a desire which he has not fulfilled? How can he say that palaces are useless? Because there is no experience about it. How can he say that beautiful women are worthless? He cannot say that, because he has not known beautiful women. Only experience can give you the key to renounce. Without experience, you can console yourself. Many poor people do that, poor in many ways. If you don't have a beautiful wife, you go and say that what is there? Body is just body, and body is mortal, and it is the abode of death. But deep down the desire remains. Desire can go only when experience has happened. You have come to know. This is a consolation. A poor man can console himself that there is nothing in the palaces, but he knows there is. Otherwise, why everybody is mad? And he himself is obsessed and mad. In his dreams, he lives in palaces. In his dreams, he becomes the emperor. But in daytime, when he is a beggar on the street, he goes on saying that I don't bother. I don't care. I have renounced. this consolation is of no use, it is dangerous, it is false. The first part of life of a right maturing person is to attain ego. And the second part, then the circle becomes complete, is to renounce it. A child grows only when he resists his parents, when he fights with the parents, when he moves away from them, against them, he attains his own individual ego. If he goes on clinging to his parents, following, he will never be an individual in his own right. He has to go astray. This is how life is meant to be. He has to become independent. And there is pain in becoming independent. There is fight. And you can fight only if you feel you are. And this is a circle. If you feel you are, you can fight more. If you fight more, you become you are more. I am. The child attains maturity when he becomes totally independent. Because of this independence, he has to go astray. The sinner may be seeking independence from the society, from the mother, from the father. The sinner is seeking independence and ego in a wrong way. The saint is also seeking independence in a right way. Ways are different, but wrong ways are always easier. To become a saint is difficult, because to become a saint, you must have been a sinner first. Try to understand this. To be a sinner, you need not be a saint first. To be a saint, you need to be a sinner first. Otherwise, your saintliness will be poor. It will not be rich. It will be flat, pale. It will not be alive. It will be a summer stream, not a flooded river. One of them went astray, which was the largest. As far as I know, the world largest in the world of seeps carries the meaning of the best. Because the larger seep is the better seep. It carries more wool. It carries more fat. It costs more to purchase it. If you sell it, you will gain more. Larger the seep, the better. Smaller the seep, the poorer. Largest means the best, and the best went astray. It is symbolic. The seaford left behind the 99. They are not worth. Why? Jesus always chooses seaford and the seep. It is very meaningful. His symbology is meaningful. The whole crowd of mediocre minds is just like sheep. They live in a crowd. Look at sheep moving on the road. They move as if they have a collective mind, not independent beings, hugging each other, huddled, afraid to move alone. They move in a crowd. I have heard one school teacher was asking to a small boy whose father was a seaford. He asked him if there are 10 sheep and one jumps out of the fence of your house, how many will remain behind? The boy said, none. The teacher said, what are you saying? I am giving you a problem of arithmetic to solve. What are you saying? 10 sheep were there, one has jumped out, how many will be left behind? The boy said, you may be knowing arithmetic, I know sheep. None. Because sheep have a collective mind. They move as a crowd. If one has jumped, all will have jumped. The shepherd left the 99 sheep behind and went in search for the one sheep who has gone astray. Jesus always says that God will go in search of the sinner, not in the search of the mediocre, the middle class, because he is not worth. He has not earned that much worth. And moreover, he is always on the path. No need to seek him, no need to search for him. And he cannot go astray. That's why the shepherd left 99 sheep in the forest in the dark night and went in search for the one who has gone astray, because the one has become the individual. The one has attained the ego. These 99 are without egos. They are a crowd. Look at your whole being. Is it still a crowd? Or have you become an ego? If you have become an ego, then God will be in search of you. It is worth. You have to be sought. You have to be found. You have gained the half circle. Now the half is the surrender. Now the half can be done through God. Only you can do the first half. The other half will be completed by the divine. When you have an ego, somewhere, in some form, God is in search of you. Because you have done your part. You have become an individual. Now, if you lose individuality, you will become universal. This is the difference. Before individuality, you are just a crowd, not universal. Just a crowd, the local crowd. Then you attain individuality, you go astray. You become independent, you become an ego. And then when you lose this ego, you become the ocean, you become the whole. Right now you are not, so you cannot become the whole. Right now the crowd exists. You are just numbers in the crowds. They do it well in the military. They give numbers to the soldiers. 1, 2, 3, 4. No names. Because really, you don't have any name. You have not earned it. You are just a number, a digit. 1, 2, 3, 4. So when somebody dies on the boat, they can write such and such numbers have fallen. They are numbers, and numbers can be replaced. When one number has fallen, another person can be replaced. He becomes number one. In military, sheeps are there. And military is the perfect society. Perfect ant-like society, the crowd. If you want to know the crowd mind, look at the military. They have to discipline you completely in such a way that you lose all independence. Order is order. You are not to think about it. They order right turn, you right turn. And this becomes so deep, I have heard, that one wife of a colonel was very much disturbed. Because whenever the colonel will sleep, on his left he will snore. And it was difficult. It was not an ordinary snore, a colonel's snore. It was like a roar. It was impossible to sleep. But whenever he will lie on his right, then he will not snore. So she went to a psychoanalyst and asked. He said, it is simple. Whenever he snores, you turn him to the right. She said, it is difficult. He is a heavy man. And then he gets angry. If I shake him and wake him, that he gets angry, and it happens so many times in the night that my whole night will be lost in this. The psychoanalyst said, don't be worried. You simply whisper in the ear of the colonel, right turn, and it will do. And it did. It goes so unconscious. Order is order. A society exists as a crowd. You can turn it into an army immediately. There is no trouble. That's why Hitler could succeed in turning the whole country in an army camp. Mao has succeeded in turning the whole country in an army camp. The society lives just on the boundary. You can turn it immediately, a little discipline, and the society can be turned into a military camp. There is no individuality. Individuality is not allowed. You should not assert yourself. This is the sheep-like crowd, the mind. Have you got any consciousness of your own? Are you simply live as a part of the society you are born in? You are a Hindu, a Mohammedan, a Christian, a Sikh, a Jain. But are you a man? You cannot say that you are a man. Because man has no society. A Socrates is a man, a Jesus is a man, a Nanak is a man, but not you. You belong, a man belongs to no one. He stands on his own feet. That is what Jesus says, the best goes astray. And once the best goes astray, the sheep left behind the 99. And he sought for the one until he found it. You go on praying for God, but he is not in search of you. That's why you miss him. First become yourself, then he will be in search of you. There is no need to seek God, and how can you seek him? You don't know the address. You don't know his abode. You know only words and theories, meaningless. They will not help. I have heard one priest arrived in a new town. The taxis were on a strike, and he had to reach the church because he had to deliver the sermon that evening. So he asked a small boy where the church is. The boy led him to the church. When he reached to the church, he thanked the boy and said him that I am very grateful that you helped me. Not only you showed me, you came with me. If you are at all interested to know where God is, come this evening to my sermon, my talk. I am going to talk about the way to the abode of the divine. The boy laughed and he said, you don't know the way to the church. How you will be knowing the way to the divine? I am not coming. But I tell you, even if you know the way to the church, it makes no difference. Everybody knows the way to the church. That makes no difference. Church is not his abode. Has never been. You cannot seek him because you don't know him. He can seek you because he knows you. And this is one of the basic teachings of Jesus, that man cannot reach the divine can reach the man. And he always reaches whenever you are ready. So the question is not to seek him, the question is just to be ready and wait. And the first readiness is to become individual, to go astray. The first thing is to be rebellious, because only then you gain into the ego. The first thing is to go beyond the crowd. That is what going astray means. To go beyond the clear-cut, formulated, limited scope of the society. Because beyond it is the wildness. Beyond it exists the vastness of the God. The society is just a clearing in the forest. It is not real. It is man created. All your laws are man created. Whatsoever you call virtue, whatsoever you call sin, is just man created. You don't know what really virtue is. This word virtue, from the Greek origin, is very beautiful. The word from the Greek means powerful. It doesn't mean good. It means virile. It means powerful. Be powerful. Assert yourself, stand on your own, don't fall a victim to the crowd, start thinking, start being yourself, and follow your lonely path, don't be a sheep. 99 sheep can be left in the forest. There is no fear about them. They will not be lost because they will huddle together. They can be found any moment. The problem is not with them, but the one, the best, has left the fold. Whenever a sheep can leave the fold means power exists there. And the sheep is not afraid of the forest. Not afraid of the wild animals, not afraid at all. The sheep has become fearless, only then she can leave the fold. And fearlessness is the first step of being ready. Ego is the first step to surrender. It looks absolutely paradoxical. You will think that I am mad. You think that humbleness is needed. I say no. First, ego is needed. Otherwise, your humbleness will be false. First, ego is needed, sharp. Sharp like a sword. That will give you a clarity of being, a distinctness. And then you can drop it. And when you have it, you can drop it. Then a humbleness comes. That humbleness is totally different. It is not humbleness of the poor. It is not humbleness of the weak. It is humbleness of the strong. It is humbleness of the powerful. Then you can yield, but not before that. He left behind the 99. He sought for the one until he had found it. And remember, you need not go to seek the God. He will come. You just become worth. He will find you. he has to make a path towards you. The moment somewhere someone is crystallized, the whole divine energy moves towards him. He may reach you as an enlightened man, he may reach you as a master, as a guru. He may reach you in a million of ways he can reach you. That is not the point, how he reaches. That is for him to worry about. It is not for you to be worried. You first attain the ego, be ready. You become individual, and then universal can happen to you. Having tired himself out, he said to the sheep, I love thee more than the 99. One who has become rebellious, God loves him more. Priests will say, what nonsense. One who has gone astray, God loves him more. The priests cannot believe in it. But this is how it happens. Jesus is the last sheep. Buddha is the last sheep. Mahavir is the last sheep. The crowd goes on moving in its mediocreness. A Mahavir, a Buddha, and a Jesus is sought out. God rushes towards them. This happened under the Bodhi tree, where Buddha was sitting, perfectly individual, with all the chains broken with society, culture, religion, all the chains broken, perfectly alone. Then God rushed from everywhere, from all directions, because he is in all directions. And Buddha became a god. And he had denied that there is no god, because that was one of the way to go astray. He had said, there is no god. I don't believe in any god. He has said, there is no society, no religion. He has denied Vedas. He has denied the system of castes, Brahmin, Sudras. He has denied the whole Hindu structure of thinking. He said, I am not a Hindu and I don't belong to any society. And I don't believe in any theories. Unless I know the truth, I'm not going to believe in anything. He went on denying. A moment came when he was alone and there was no link with anything, absolutely broken. He became an island. Absolutely alone under that Bodhi tree. 25 centuries before, God rushed from everywhere to this man, to this sheep who has gone astray, and told Buddha, having tired himself out, he said to the sheep, I love thee more than the 99. This was said to Jesus. This has always been so. This is the foundational law. God seeks the man, not the man. Man has to be just ready. And how to be ready? To become individual. To be a revolutionary. To go beyond the society. To be fearless. To break all chains, all relationships. To be alone. And exist as if you are the center of the world. Then God rushes towards you. And in his rush, your ego is lost. The island disappears into the ocean. Suddenly, you are no more. First, the society has to be dropped. And that is the inner mechanics. Because your ego can exist only with the society. If you go on dropping the society, there will come a moment when the ego will be alone, because the society has been dropped, but then the ego cannot exist without the society. because society helps you to exist as an ego. If you go on dropping the society, by and by the basis drop, when there is no Tao, the I cannot exist. Then at the final stage, I disappears because Tao has been dropped. When there is no you, I am not. The you has to be dropped, then the I drops. But by dropping you, first the I becomes sharper, crystallized, centered, beautiful, powerful. Then it is consumed. This is the rush of the divine. Jesus was crucified because of these sayings. He was making people rebellious. He was teaching them to go astray. He was saying that God loves the one who has gone astray, the sinner, the rebel, the egoist. Jews could not tolerate it. It was too much. This man had to be put to silence. This man has to be stopped. He is going far away. He will destroy the whole society. He is creating such a situation in which the priest will not be able to stand, the church will dissolve. He is against the crowd, and crowd is all that is around you. And the crowd became panic-stricken. They thought this man is the enemy. He is cutting the very base. Without the crowd, how can we live? Going and teaching the 99 sheep that go astray, they will huddle more together. And if you go on teaching, they will take revenge. They will kill you. They will say enough is enough. We live in the crowd. We are part of the crowd. Alone we cannot exist. We don't know how to be alone. We always exist with the other. The other is needed. It is a must. Without the other, who you are? The identity is lost. This is the problem. 99 sheep create all religions. And the real religion happens only to the one sheep who has gone astray. Be courageous. Move beyond the clearing. Go to the wild. Life is there. And then only you will grow. There may be suffering because there is no growth without suffering. There may be a cross, crucifixion, because there is no maturity through crucifixion. The society may take the revenge. Accept it. That is bound to be so. Because when the one sheep comes back, the 99 will say, this is the sinner. This sheep went astray. This is no part of us. This sheep doesn't belong to us. And those 99 sheep will be absolutely unable to conceive that the shepherd is carrying that sheep on his shoulders. Because this is the last sheep and has been found. Jesus says the shepherd will go back at his home. He will call his friends and he will have a feast. Because a sheep was lost and a sheep has been found. Jesus says whenever a sinner enters into the heaven, there is rejoicing. Because a sheep has been lost and the sheep has been found. Enough for today.